Mic check. Hello. John.
I can
Hi.
hear you, Marco.
Hi, everybody.
Hi.
Good to see everyone.
It's my sound system.
Hello.
The two from Germany are quite inspiring in the sense that it's 2 o'clock in the morning, right?
Yeah, you see the aura, yeah? Do you see it? Yeah.
It was the hour before the gods awake.
Yes, exactly.
Marco, you look like you're in your pajamas.
I am. I am. Do you want to see it?
They look great on you.
Yeah. Actually, this is pullover. This is a pajama.
Oh,
It's becoming cold
is it?
slowly.
Oh, you're fine.
Not cold, but cooler.
We're having a heat wave here, so you're lucky.
Manhattan?
Yeah, I'm sitting in front of a fan. We've had sweltering heat the last 2 or 3 days.
Interesting. We're having an early autumn here in the Santa Cruz Mountains. It's cooled down.
Oh, I'm looking forward to that. Yeah, it was like 96 degrees the last 2 days. Yeah.
That's so hot when you're in a city. Oh my goodness.
It's wonderful. You just bake.
Your own private sauna.
That's right. That's right.
You're traveling soon, Mateo, teacher.
2 weeks. Yeah,
2 weeks.
3 weeks, September 18th. So that's why I'm working off the inspiration of the Germans.
Bring your pajamas.
But American pajamas are more colored. Bring the American pajamas. They have much more colors. Not just gray. This is so great.
Superhero pajamas. How about Batman and Robin when I was a kid? Yeah.
Sort of like Douglas's t-shirt. Nice and bright colors. Yeah.
This is just daytime clothes, but I can wear it at night too.
You wear that to work? That's great.
That'd be nice.
Well, I wore my pink shirt for today.
I like those suspenders, Jeffrey. Those are nice.
And I always notice Tony is very, I don't know the term, but well dressed, definitely. Not in his pajamas, but
Very
or maybe
dapper.
their fancy pajamas.
Oh, you're
Not
muted, Tony.
Can you hear me now?
Yes.
You know, I have a similar shirt, also like kind of hippy dippy, you know. Can you hear me?
Yeah.
Yes,
I
I'm
can hear
waving
you.
to Oro.
Hi.
I got the
Hi.
same hippy dippy type of shirts, but I didn't wear them, so
Hello.
I want to be a little bit more serious.
Right.
Hello, Oro. Oh, and
Yes.
hi, Lauren.
Yeah, it's a funny thing where I'm like, "Are you happy?" And he's like, "No, me Aurobindo."
He's looking fashionable too.
That's right.
Oro and Douglas got the memo. We all missed it. It's tie-dye Thursday.
Yeah. Yeah, you guys are matching. Cute. Coconut water.
Oh, why don't we get started? Meditation. And just for anyone watching this, is a Life Divine Reading Group. And for this week, we read from Book Two, The Knowledge and the Ignorance, The Spiritual Evolution, Part One, and the last two chapters of Part One of Book Two. Chapter 13, Exclusive Concentration of Consciousness Force and the Ignorance. And Chapter 14, The Origin and Remedy of Falsehood, Error, wrong and evil. So that was our reading for today. And after the meditation, we could start with an open frame. If somebody would like to suggest a particular direction, you could do so at that time. Unless anyone has a particular kind of meditation or invocation or intonation that they want to do, speak now. Otherwise, I'll start with a simple bell.
Well, I think we could start with, I always like the little epigram at the beginning of the chapter. So I just like to start with the epigram for the chapter 13.
Okay.
So maybe we could do like the last time, a minute, then you do the bell and then I'll read the text and then we'll continue. Okay.
Okay. So let's begin the minute.
From the kindled fire of energy of consciousness, truth was born and the law of truth. From that the night, from the night, the flowing ocean of being. From the kindled fire of energy of consciousness, truth was born and the law of truth. From that the night, from the night, the flowing ocean of being.
What did people think about his treaty on the altruist toward the end of the last chapter? About 2 pages kind of critiquing the altruist's ego aggrandizement. And I don't know, did we all get that far in the reading? It's right at the end. We don't have to start there. I just read it just now.
Yeah. I thought about a woman I know who's kind of a maybe, you know, fundamentalist Christian, and, you know, she's very altruistic, but in a self promoting way. So like, I do so much for the community and so on. You know, I thought about her. It's very, you know, there's this Christian idea of love that could be, you know, it could be practiced that way, in an altruistic way that's kind of self-uplifting in a negative sense. It's very interesting. I think he's a very, very good psychologist, I mean, to see such things.
It then culminates in this passage on oneness that I would love to read, kind of the tail end of the paragraph. If your paragraphs are numbered, it's the 34th paragraph. If we have the same pagination, it would be 653, but I know we have different paginations. And so paragraph 34, it's about, it's 1, 2, 3 paragraphs from the end of the chapter, if that's helpful. And it's coming after the paragraph on the altruist. And then he talks about, he talks kind of somewhere in the middle of the paragraph, I'll start. It is when others are known and felt intimately as oneself that this ideal can become a natural and spontaneous rule of our living and be realized in practice as in principle. But even oneness with others is not enough by itself, if it is a oneness with their ignorance. For then the law of ignorance will work, and error of action and wrong action will survive, even if diminished in degree and mellowed in incidence and character. Our oneness with others must be fundamental, not a oneness with their minds, hearts, vital selves, egos, even though these come to be included in our universalized consciousness, but a oneness in the soul and spirit. And that can only come by our liberation into soul awareness and self-knowledge.
Well, one thing I think is remarkable and distinguished, although not necessarily unique, about this text and Aurobindo's description of reality and of the different planes, levels of the manifestation, from the inconscience to the superconscience, is that it's very gradated. And so I think he goes to pains to establish the necessity of even that which seems to be unnecessary or that we would wish to expunge from the cosmic record or the cosmic reality. So evil, falsehood, wrongness. The difference between altruism and just vile egotism, pure narcissism or destructive behavior, I think, even though they're at root both forms of self-assertion, of egoic self-assertion, I think that he would recognize a gradation there as well. We would rather live in a world of philanthropists than a world of psychotics. Not to say that there can't be overlap between philanthropists and psychotics, but I think that he recognizes and affirms that gradated concept of consciousness development or of moral development or of spiritual transformation. What I think is interesting is that, you know, he locates evil, falseness, wrongness, error, etc., all within one particular plane. It's the plane of life and mind, the life instincts, the life desires, the compulsions, not only of human beings, but also animals, but then the mental constructions that he says are all fundamentally erroneous. There's something limited inherently about any mental construction. So you can't construct a moral, ethical, virtuous good. You can't find the good, basically, in or the original good, the real good, in the mental plane. It has to be in the infinite and in the absolute. And then he says that evil and error and falsehood doesn't have the same ontological status as the absolute. It's derivative. It's not a cosmic principle. It's not an original principle. It's something that arises in the process of manifestation at this stage of life and the mind. And that the only way truly out of it, the only way to transcend or to transmute or to undo, or maybe not the right words, but the only way is for that transformation to occur, that fundamental transformation. And so just a couple lines down from the passage you read, Mateo, this struck me, and I marked it all up. That is one reason, referring to the necessity for oneness, that why a spiritual call must be accepted as imperative and take precedence over all other claims, intellectual, ethical, social, that belong to the domain of ignorance. And I that struck me because it's a prioritization of motives, I think. And I think that even though from the integral perspective, we might want to balance and harmonize everything, and I think that there's a truth to that, within that balancing and harmonization of elements, to have a priority, I think is a significant statement. And it's something that I'm dwelling on.
So I also wanted to talk about a similar understanding, but slightly different. So the reason why I wanted to read that first quote is because he gives value to the negative, the night, the darkness, the things that we often disregard. We often focus on the light to the exclusion. I've always felt that the darkness gets bad press in the way that we deal with it. We tend to view light as good and dark as bad. And he doesn't do that. He says the dark is what gives the place for the ocean of being, which is, it's hard to come up with a more positive understanding of the dark than that. So, and then in a way, I'm not surprised when I get to the section on altruism, because he does the same thing, just as he turns the dark, even part of the argument is this idea that evil is necessary to the awakening. It's part of the awakening, right? So it has this flip. So it's part of, you're talking about gradation, Marco, but I think it's also this flipping in this kind of inverting our thinking about these two ideas. So the altruism is an example of something that is usually thought of as light and that he presents as having dark elements in it, right? So again, we're playing with these concepts, or not necessarily playing with them in a negative sense, but asking us to rethink some of these ideas in interesting ways. And I think one of the reasons why I wanted to talk about that is because, so it's my, starting from tomorrow night at midnight, I'm going to be writing a novel in 3 days, because it's an annual competition that happens around the world, and I've done it, it's the fourth year I'm doing it. And the book that I'm planning to write in the 3 days is a book about the nature of goodness, because it's based on the experience of people in the Second World War who saved the lives of other people, Jewish people, people with disability, and so forth, faced with the Nazis. So faced with what we today consider to be a kind of an extreme form of evil. And one of the reasons why I'm interested in this particular story is because I find that we ordinary human beings have as much difficulty understanding people who act in a good way as we have difficulty in understanding people who act in an evil way. So it's a kind of, it's not something that Aurobindo talks about directly, but he uses this idea of ignorance to frame the question of evil. And one can use the same idea to frame the question of good. So he talks about the problem of evil, right, which is a phrase that we use. But I think there's a problem of good too. It's not a phrase that we use that way, but we have trouble understanding people who act altruistically in such an extreme way, where they put into danger their own lives, the lives of their families, the lives of their children, in order to save someone else. Anyway, so it's these particular two chapters speak to me directly in terms of the exercise that I'm about to take part in. So I thought it was really interesting. The other thing I wanted to say really quickly is that maybe, I'm not sure whether it was reading this or through even just your comments, Marco, but I've always had trouble all along with this idea of the absolute. Not a guy who favors kind of an absolute view of things, but I can work with it as a derivative concept from the infinite, because in the infinite, all relativities become absolute. And so I can, I think Aurobindo wants it the other way around. I think his first thing is absolute, and the infinite is somehow a related concept. And he starts from the absolute, but that's my understanding of it. But I think it's interesting to flip that and view the starting point as the infinite, and then as I say, that kind of leads to the absolute. And it's a way of understanding the absolute that I find, which is kind of an insight that I don't know if it's an epiphany, but it's an insight. Anyway.
I'd like to share a line, a sentence from Savitri. In Savitri, there are two cantos that people bounce off of because there are the gradations that the two main protagonists are Ashwapati and Savitri. And it starts off with 18 cantos of Ashwapati's yoga, Sri Aurobindo's yoga, and it's walking us through the different parts of our being and the planes of consciousness. And then he gets to this realm between the kingdoms and godheads of life and the kingdoms and godheads of mind. And kind of sandwiched between those is the descent into night and the world of falsehood, the mother of evil, and the sons of darkness. And these are very Vedic terms, the mother of evil and the sons of darkness. But people bounce off of these. And interestingly enough, when I was in Germany, most of the lovers of Savitri, these were their two favorite cantos, because they're in the part of their yogic sadhana is, and this is a generalization, but I just found it over and over again, is rooting out, understanding evil and falsehood and darkness in order to not let it happen again, in order to have some sort of developed vigilance against it. And there's this one sentence in the canto, the world of falsehood, the mother of evil, and the sons of darkness. It's five lines, one sentence. All who would raise the fallen world must come under the dangerous arches of their power. For even the radiant children of the gods to darken their privilege is the dreadful rite. None can reach heaven who has not passed through hell.
One of the things I think I learned in this chapter is that although we will often regard dualities like good and evil, or absolute and relative, or infinite and finite as equal in a way, like you have to have one to have the other, they imply each other, they arise together. Aurobindo is positing that the absolute, or what he calls the absolute, is prior to. Like, so the good, the truth, is not the opposite of the evil or the untrue, the lie. It's prior to, and those darker forces or aspects are derived from that prior term, the prior reality. And the other part of it, which I think is the theoretical side of the verse that you read, and this idea of sons of darkness and the mother of evil. In the text, paragraph 6 and 7 of the Origin of Falsehood and Evil, the chapter 14, he talks about planes of superphysical experience. I'll just read it. It was for a long time held by the human mind as a traditional knowledge that when we go beyond the material plane, these things are found to exist there also in worlds beyond us. There are in these planes of physical experience, powers, and forms of vital mind and life that seem to be the pre-physical foundation of the discordant, defective, or perverse forms and powers of the life mind and life force, which we find in the terrestrial existence. So this becomes clearer on the next page in paragraph 7, where he says, as there are powers of knowledge or forces of the light, so there are powers of ignorance and tenebrous forces of the darkness, whose work is to prolong the reign of ignorance and inconscience. And what I think is interesting is that he's not only like situating the evil in human nature or in the mental, you know, the animal nature, but also in these, what he calls forces. I think we could perhaps refer to them as subtle realm entities or what have you, super physical, that themselves have their own will, their own mode of acting, their own intention. And in other parts of this chapter, he talks about how individuals can become possessed by these forces, and that it takes that psychic being, that psychic entity that has the intuition of the whole or the supramental, to liberate the self from those entrapments. And it's like, part of the journey of the self, part of the adventure of the spirit or the soul, is to pass through all the darkness, to pass through all the night, and to know it, and then to come through into this transformed consciousness that is clear on its fundamental nature. And I'm reflecting on this partly because when I came to this reading, one of the first things that bothered me was the question of evil. And so it seems like we've really kind of gotten to, I'm seeing what his story is really, like for the role of these dark forces and the role for them in the adventure of consciousness. So I don't have an exact kind of landing place for that point, but the poetry, Jeffrey's point as well, I think, about the problem of good, because what seems so impossible in a world that is just a film, like a sheath removed from the hell realm, is that there could be something good, something true, that is fundamental. I think that that's an extraordinary communication. So that's all.
It's typical for the Eastern religions, Buddhism, Hinduism, to say that evil is ignorance. So evil is just, it's not like light or not like Brahman. It's not a clear perception of how the world is. It's ignorance. I heard once that I think even, I don't know about Charles Taylor, and I'm not a scholar, but I heard him saying that Christianity has a very good and refined understanding of evil, and that's actually what makes Christianity strong. So I don't know, maybe. But this understanding that evil is ignorance, that's very interesting. I mean, it sounds very true to me. So you can see it that way. I mean, it's just been just unconscious when we are evil, and we need to break out of the darkness.
I'd like to comment just really briefly on the difference between ignorance and falsehood. Ignorance is not knowing. It's part of mental consciousness. And I think really simply that falsehood is knowingly or not knowingly bending a rendition of a truth to the ego. It's a subtle but not so subtle difference. And that's kind of why he's commenting in this whole chapter on kind of very subtle and not so subtle falsehood rather than ignorance. But he also brings in the gunas, I don't know if he calls them that, so I could check, but I don't want to talk too long. But it's like linked in with the vital ego, and he brings in the mental gunas, the inconscience, inertia, tamas, and then the passion and fire and movement, rajas, and then harmony and sattva, and he even talks about the shadow of all of those because they're bent based on the mental consciousness, and then they're also based, the gunas exist on all these different levels. They take on different forms in the physical, they take on different forms in vitality, and he's kind of teasing out falsehood through all of this intermixture, and he's also teasing out the difference between ignorance and falsehood in this light. It's quite complex. I mean, I could go on and on about it, but it's just super complex.
But just he does also distinguish between evil and ignorance. So even though evil comes out of ignorance, it also takes on a life of its own. I think that's partly what he's saying in these other passages about how these forces or forms develop that really carry in the intentionality of evil in their own assertion, in their self-assertion. And those are these sort of free-floating, intensities or something that, but it is complex because there's a kind of this genetic process where you get the concentration. In order to have a self that distinguishes itself from the inconscience, there's a concentration of the conscious force. And that concentration creates this exclusivity where the being has the regard for itself in order to survive, reproduce, etc. But then that, when it becomes more powerful, it becomes more capable of seeking solely to aggrandize itself, even at the expense of all others and the rest of reality. And that's where I think evil is kind of born in this tale, is when the mental can begin to assert itself, assert the self, the egoic, the separate self, with strategy, with forethought, with intention. Like that becomes evil then. It's not just ignorance. It starts as ignorance, but then it becomes evil. And that's, I think, an interesting way of looking at it, looking how it develops and unfolds.
It's interesting just mentally right now comparing the Christian view of evil, and I don't think there's a mention of sin in this chapter, but it seems to be implied. I'm well aware that Aurobindo was likely well aware of Christian theology to some extent. And so Charles Taylor, when he made the statement that Christianity has a refined understanding of evil, maybe if you're a theologian, but if you're a lay Christian, it'll depend on who you've spoken to. And so if we go back to the altruist, that will be, or the fundamentalist, that's a ignorant understanding of evil. And then, yeah, like Marco was saying, and Mateo, it builds into ideas of falsehood and and mental evils, I suppose. But
what for me at least was particularly helpful in reading these parts, this chapter about the origin of falsehood and evil, was this evolutionary aspect, the usefulness of this dark side of our existence. It's not just something there and that's there and we must go through and that's so, but it has a utility in our evolution, in our development. Because, and it was always for me somehow, especially when I was younger, a problem. Well, it's still today to some degree, but this idea that there is some almighty divine being, God, Godhead, that is supposed to be pure love and grace and so on. And yet we live in a world which is not only love. There are a lot of negative things that happen. And the question that arises, and always from the side of the materialists, from the atheists, well, if God exists, why does it does he allow, or he allow it he she I don't know allow for evil and falsehood in the history of human history, at least? And I never found a real answer, satisfying answer. Here it's 80% for me in the sense that there is not a complete satisfactory answer for me, but it is a step forward in the sense that I do not accept evil, but I understand it to some degree. It helps us to grow. It's after all an experience that I think more or less every one of us has. Sufferance, pain can be something that helps us to grow. And we more or less consciously or unconsciously know this, but here it is expressed more clearly. And it is to some degree a sort of law of nature, or at least that kind of nature in which this kind of cosmos that we experience, earthly nature. There are, according to Sri Aurobindo, there are planes where this is not so. And for me, it was quite helpful also in the daily life when something negative happens and there's still this light in the background and that tells me, okay, maybe this evil that happened or this falsehood that I see or also experience helps me to grow and helps others to grow. And I think this is actually the situation where humanity is. And yeah, as Matteo also read from Savitri, none can reach heaven who has not passed through hell. This makes very much sense for me.
I guess it also depends on how deep you're willing to go into hell too. Sometimes it can be a personal choice to take the burden upon yourself. And I noticed some of my notes from 10 years ago when I read this, I was more focused on, I was younger, so I had more evil inside of me or these tendencies towards self-destruction, I suppose, or whatever term you want to insert there. And it's paragraph 9, which I won't do any reading, but that's when he addresses, well, if there's an absolute good, then there must be, it's a mistake to deny the absoluteness of evil. And I underlined that in the past. I still, for me, kind of how you had an 80% overall, yeah, it's good. I still don't have a full definition as to why. Well, why couldn't nothingness be something? Looking at Aurobindo's main scheme of everything, it makes sense why he didn't touch on this, but I felt like this could be a separate chapter alone, exploring why this is not so, or at least in more detail for me. I just simply stating, well, because he says, for the absolute is not itself a thing of magnitude, it is beyond measure, but in the freedom of its essential being. And essentially he's going back into explaining, well, evil doesn't explain, I don't know how to explain it, but so that for me, I still need more explanation for myself as to why that's not so.
Could I back us up to the two chapters in part book one, the delight of existence, the problem and the solution? I'll just summarize really quick because I'm hearing partial points and a couple missing. He basically said it's the question of theodicy, the classic philosophical question of if God is all benevolent, why do we see evil and falsehood and people killing each other and hordes dying in with global climate change, earthquakes and things like that, war and all that. So he starts off by saying that the background is bliss. We have a misperception because suffering and pain spring off of the background. It's kind of a signal versus noise. We take bliss for granted because when suffering comes, it becomes all consuming and we think that all life is suffering. And so he's saying that it's kind of natural to the human consciousness to have a misperception, to elevate it. It's almost in scientific terms, in scientific experimentation, it's signal versus noise. If the background is all bliss, we're actually not going, if the fish is in water, it's not going to detect water. He postulates that we're not detecting divine bliss and pure bliss. And then the second point that he brings in, and maybe I'm not doing it in the right order, is that that question of theodicy only arises if we have an Abrahamic conception of God as other, right? And we're missing, and he's saying we're missing the immanent Godhead, we're missing the psychic being. And then he kind of goes on this treatise of how pain and suffering and like people dying in natural disasters and things like that. It's an ethical, we look at it with an ethical perspective, and that's just a mental perspective, and nature is non-ethical in that sense. These things do happen and these movements do happen, and it seems like nature doesn't even care, but it's really just nature not having our mental ethical conception of things in the way that we do. And then the fourth point that's been being talked about is the actual evolutionary necessity to spur us into becoming and realize the necessity of pain, evil, suffering, death, falsehood to spur us into a consciousness is more expansive than our human ranges of consciousness. That's it, more or less. And it, to me, it's like it's yeah. The argument is so beautiful. And yeah, that's probably it. And I don't want to neglect the first chapter. This first chapter that we read about chit tapas, consciousness heat, and chit shakti, consciousness force. It's tapas is Wow, it's such a beautiful chapter. It's actually one of my 20 favorite in the book.
Could you maybe explain tapas?
Tapas, heat.
Yes.
Heat, and it's exclusive. Yeah, it's always, he actually never talks about consciousness alone. It's always chit shakti, consciousness of shakti, the divine mother and the mediating force of creation, and that being the force of chit tapas, the heat of movement.
It's the heat of Satchit Ananda.
Yeah, in a sense. Mm.
So, you know, in those last pages, those last two pages, Matteo.
Chapter?
It's the last chapter of the second book, first part of the second book, chapter 14, chapter 14, der Ursprung und die Überwindung, the last page, on the very last page, he describes the triple transformation. He describes this whole process of yoga, right? In the very last page. And so there's this three-step process, basically. And is that what he means by the triple transformation?
The three, kind of, yes. But the three steps in the second to the last paragraph, the three steps are him walking us through his major realizations on which the yoga is based. And if like when I think about the specialness of Sri Aurobindo, it's not uniqueness of writing. It's writing all of this stuff, gaining the yogic keys, then actually working through all the planes of consciousness to manifest, to bring down and anchor down this consciousness through these yogic tools. The what they called the supramental manifestation. They were. They, being the mother and Sri Aurobindo, were very actively working on the realization of this and the anchoring of higher realms of consciousness within the atmosphere of the earth. So he walks us through his three major realizations. That's the first, second, and third, when he's saying you must do this and you must do this, like talk about spiritual imperative. And then the last chapter is the supramental of the triple transformation. It's psychic transformation, spiritual transformation, the supramental transformation. The last paragraph of this chapter is the third of those three. But yeah, and he will go into way, way more detail in the chapter titled The Triple Transformation that we're getting to, the fourth to the last chapter of the book or something like that.
Referring back to that section in the first, in the chapter 13 on tapas, that sort of opening section there, I just wanted to point out that it was one of the things I was quite interested in is this discussion of concentration and then this sort of self-obvious self-immersion and self-held dwelling, self-contained extension. So this idea of the self. So for those of us who've been looking at this issue of field effects in the poetic context, in another part of the site, the three main qualities of characteristics of field are present in this text. So the self-referentiality, which is a part of a field, the connectedness is a part of field, and the boundedness is part of the field. And all three of those concepts are discussed in this section. So it is actually a quite a an interesting and grounded discussion of field effects.
Could you repeat that, please, Jeffrey? Those three things: bounded,
so bounded, self-referential, and connectedness. So he talks about the way things are connected to each other within this thing. The self-referential referentiality he talks about quite extensively, and the boundedness of this as well. So it's because it relates to our other discussions about this.
So you need a bounded area.
Yes.
And then another bounded area.
Yes.
They can't overlap.
And he talks about single fields, and he talks about multiple fields. It's right after the discussion about the many and the one. And so he's interested in the relationship between the many and the one, and how each one, how there are different ways of viewing that. So anyway, I thought it was an interesting discussion and relevant to our other talk.
You're talking about paragraph 2. Sorry to interrupt, John.
Yes.
Where he walks us through first, second, third, fourth.
No, I'm talking about paragraph 3 and 4.
Concentration in this sense of the self-held dwelling. In itself, on itself as object, that one?
Yeah.
Just quickly, I noted in the margins there, Sloterdijk and spheres, because this is another conversation that we've had, is that human or conscious being always has a sphere. So the self-held dwelling brought that to mind.
When did Sloterdijk, and what is this other field theory? When did these writings occur?
Well, the field stuff is my own work in relation to collaborators. Mm. And the Sloterdijk is 2000, roughly. So we're talking, these are all fairly recent references.
I'm not a mathematician or a logician, but I was recently reading about a cube has six sides, but you can only see three of them at once. But if you could see all six sides, you would lose dimensionality. And I'm reading Aurobindo is a challenge, because it's sometimes difficult to figure out which plane he's observing from. Sometimes he's obviously on one plane looking at another plane. Sometimes he's in between. And his language, I think, reflects this fluid and dynamic and very nonlinear way of thinking, which I think probably confused him as much as it confused his listeners. I think he wouldn't have had to write this book if it was all obvious. I think there's a very curious, I'm looking at, in my edition, it's on page 606, the middle paragraph. He talks about the powers of the Prince of Air. He's talking about the supraphysical aspects. He mentions their supraphysical aspects and influences on Earth nature can be explained by the coexistence of worlds of a descending evolution with parallel worlds of an ascending evolution, not precisely created by Earth existence, but created as an annex to the descending world order and a prepared support for the evolutionary terrestrial formations. To me, this is a kind of mid-world between the ascending and the descending currents that in some ways mimic the Earth conditions. And I believe this has a lot to do with the hybrid, the nature of the hybrid, when the subtle is physical, the physical subtle. You can have the subtle, you can have the physical, you can have the subtle physical. And I think this is where it gets very tricky. And I don't want to be critical of Aurobindo because he's such a genius. And this is so rich what he's exploring here. And it's so impossibly difficult to talk about. As he well knows, our vocabulary is extremely clunky. Most of us are operating linguistically in an ego with walls, rather than an ego with fences, much less an ego that is diaphanous. So it's a... It's with great trepidation that I talk about this. And I don't even know if I have permission, but I had some experiences that were of, where I think I was exploring the in-between, these hybrid worlds without any guidance. That's probably because there aren't that many people who go this way. And the few people that I did consult were very cautious. But I had these experiences, and I'm only going to speak about one because I think it sort of illustrates some of our confusion about evil and goodness and altruism and a lot of the comments that have been made here. I was doing a lot of healing work, a lot of body work, and I was working with a lot of people who are very ill. I was working at the... at an AIDS organization during the 80s and the 90s. And I was working with one gentleman over a year, and he was very ill, and he had pneumocystis pneumonia, and he was in the last stages. And I was giving him daily Reiki treatments, which is hands-on, very energetic, working very subtle levels of energy. And I became aware of my own tendencies as I worked with lots of different people in these kinds of extreme situations, that I was picking up on stuff that wasn't originating for me, but had to do with this subtle physical in between. So it wasn't something that, so I would just put my hands down and I would feel a current flowing between us. But I would pick up on things. But one time, this particular person, I was very close to him. It's a strong bond between us. And he'd been coughing constantly, big hacking coughs. And he wanted to go to the country. It was wintertime. And I found a place for us to go. A friend of mine hosted this event. And his coughing got so bad one night, and it was keeping up the whole house. And we sort of gathered around him. And something really weird happened. It's like I started coughing. And I took on the cough. And everyone turned and looked at me. And Marcus stopped coughing while I was coughing. And I coughed for about an hour. And they looked like they were getting ready to take me to the emergency room. And I said, no, everything's fine. And then I stopped coughing. Marcus had stopped coughing while I was coughing. And everyone went to sleep. We all had a good night's sleep. And he noted it. He said, while you were coughing, I stopped coughing. And I said, yes, I know. A few months later, he had died. And he told me before he died that he was going to take me with him. And so after he died, I explored different kinds of spaces with him, which were the tremendously exhilarating and joyous and perplexing, to say the least. But I'm just sharing this with you guys because I realized I could take on the symptom of another person through an altruistic desire, but it wouldn't have solved any problems. And I think that's what Marcus was letting me know. And I think every parent or anyone who's loved someone and they're seeing their suffering and they just want to take it on, relieve another person's suffering, it doesn't work. And I think that's because we get confused about these levels. On one level, what looks so horrific and suffering, on another level, it's gone, it's vanished, it's total bliss. But I think when we're in the between, these hybrids, these mid-worlds, where these transitions are happening between matter and subtle and super subtle, that some persons can really get stuck. And I speak from my own experience. And that's why I'm like, there's all this stuff about good and evil. It's always just baffled me, you know. And I'm not saying, I think that part of our growing up is, as human beings and as cosmic beings, is to be able to differentiate the egoic, which is what I think he's calling middle truth, and the post-egoic. And this is, can be languaged in many different ways. Many different schools of psychology do language it radically different ways. I think the pre-egoic is often demonic voices. And they can really scare you shitless. And they can do things like bump things in the night. And they can move things around. And then there's the egoic self, which he does a great job of showing the healthy and the unhealthy sides of the ego. And I think there's that post-ego that's starting to open up for some of us, but it's a very iffy kind of proposition. Because I think, and I think that's what he's tracking. In most of this text, he seems to be, for me, he's going from heart, he's doing that here, 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 and mostly up here. But I'm suspicious that, I think that was absolutely necessary for what he was doing. But I think as a postmoderns, I think our current is much more descending and incarnational. And I believe we're working with the sex center and the root center. And I believe that's why we're seeing the kinds of issues, you know, around human sexuality and redefining masculine and feminine sexual orientation. And those issues are very crucial. And the root center, which is connects us very much to the earth. And that's why I'm cautious about this, because I think he's primarily doing he talks about involution and evolution, but I think he's very attached to an ascending current. And I think that it's very touching what Banerjee said, that he did not, that the Second World War took him by surprise. Even a man as psychically attuned as he was did not pick up on the Second World War. And he was in the midst of it, and he definitely, I think, was moved by it. And he used all of his psychic capacities to create a better outcome than would have been the outcome if Hitler had won that war. So I think that, but I'm a little cautious about, because I think Margaret Mead, the anthropologist, said something I think was very true. She was working with people who were younger than her, and they all loved her, and they said, "Oh, Margaret, you're just like us." And she says, "No, I'm not like you. I was born before the atomic bomb. You were born after the atomic bomb. I am not like you." And I get the feeling as I read him, as brilliant a genius as he is and was, that he was born before the atomic bomb, and I think he was talking to a population that was before that. And I think all of us have been born after the atomic bomb, and all kinds of technologies have unleashed all kinds of horrors and potential horrors. So I think that we should take great inspiration from his example. But I don't live in an ashram, and I never will. And I live in Manhattan, and I have to chop wood and carry water and make a living here. And everyone I know does as well. And I think the challenges that we have are related, but also different. So I hope some of that made sense. I'm trying to figure this out. Thanks.
Could you quickly repeat the we that's operating from the root? I missed that part. I didn't know if you meant
the root in the chakra system. The chakra system, the root is between the it's at the perineum.
And who did you say was operating? Was that society as a whole or America?
No,
or
I'm saying that in the tantric tradition, it's the sex center and the root are very important in tantra. And Kali and a lot of these entities, which in a conformist kind of traditional way, they look terrifying. You know, traditionally she has a necklace of bones and she's standing on a prostrate man and she's conducting a kind of a psychic rape on the guy. She's sucking up. She has a very vampiric energy. I think that is the kind of, I think Kali was banished from the ashram. I don't think that's what the mother was doing. And I don't think that's, you're shaking your head, Mateo. Thank you for your correction. I think though that there was a political reason, and a very good one, why they were not bringing in those traditional tantric motifs and focusing on a different style. And I think you can see it in this text that he's looking at the mythic and with great respect and I believe he mentions over and over that there are different myths from around the world that complement, I think, what he's doing. But at any rate, I think I've said enough. And if Mateo has a different take on this, I'm very delighted to hear about it. Thanks.
For you jump in, Mateo. I'm going to let Kim in. She's been waiting for a bit. But we can go on. She knows the deal.
John, that was beautiful. I'm not going to say that I have a different take.
I just saw you shaking your head like this.
I shook my head about the Kali wasn't allowed in the ashram. I don't know the history and the details of everything, but I've certainly reflected in Sri Aurobindo's letters on the mother, where he talks about the different forms of Kali that we have access to. Specifically, he in letters on the mother, he talks about different ways of experiencing Mahakali energy and how she has different colors. The Kali that you're talking about is the Kali that rules the vital plane. The Kali that's supramental, he says, is filled with golden light and is not the black Kali that we're used to representation that we're used to. I appreciate your hypothesis that he's focused on the descent. I don't
ascent.
I don't have the same. In book 7 of Savitri, the book of yoga, it's all focused on interiorization, but book 2 is it would be integral yoga often gets called double tantric yoga because it's not tantric, it's not Vedic, it's both. It's the ascent and the descent and the completeness of those two without exclusivity. specifically working with the different natures among us. So it's not like I would have a different take. I don't want to focus on any one aspect of what you just said, because what you just said was absolutely beautiful and tender and open and exploratory. So I wouldn't want to get in like a tit for tat back and forth discourse. That's kind of ridiculous. Right. But it's just that there's a lot of misideas floating around about the ashram and integral yoga. And I'm not privy to all the little minutiae. There's a wonderful book called it's so beautiful. It's called Evening Talks. And this is an ashramite, A.B. Purani, that was one of the most advanced yogis in the ashram, writing his record about what Sri Aurobindo would say after evening meditations leading up to 1926, and then after he broke his thigh bone in 1938. So from 1938 continuing on till about 1950. I mean, he did go quiet a lot of those times because of the deep inner work that he was doing. But he in evening talks, he's a lot more free-flowing. I really think you'd appreciate the book. It's a lot more free-flowing and open, but it's not his words exactly, but it's the accounting of someone who is quite advanced. But chapter 6 of The Mother, which is Sri Aurobindo writing on the powers of the Divine Mother, it's Mahalakshmi. Chapter 6 is one of the most beautiful written expositions on the divine feminine. I think I've never read anything more beautiful on the divine feminine than chapter 6 of The Mother. It's basically laying out showing the Mahashakti as being as powers descending and ascending, the forces of Maheshwari, wisdom, Mahakali, force, power, Mahalakshmi, divine beauty, and Mahasaraswati, work in perfection, and my goodness, it's that's enough.
Well, thank you for that. It could be my own myopic, I'm trying to move from my own experience to other people's experiences and find a good fit, and we may be drawing on similar different traditions and finding what's in between culturally that is has some vibrancy and some I think that my feeling is that it was something Whitehead said about a statement. It's more important that a statement be interesting than true or false. And of course, this is coming from a philosopher who knew logic very well. And I think Aurobindo was a poet, and he wrote in different registers. And those evening talks among people who have a very shared world view, there would be a different kind of discourse, no doubt, than in a big volume like this, which I think was for a different kind of audience. So I'm definitely a beginner at Aurobindo, getting a little more efficient, I think, because I don't find myself, I found these this second book extremely inspiring. And as difficult as it is, it's actually fairly easy for me to follow compared to the first book. And I also took your suggestion. I had this book on my shelf for years, The Greater Psychology. You mentioned this book, and I remembered that I had it after you mentioned it. And then I looked at it, and I realized why I hadn't read it. But now I believe, having had this slow and careful kind of reading that we've been doing, I can go to a book like this, and it just makes total sense. So that's extremely encouraging. So thank you. It's getting easier and easier, and also much more complex as well. But I'm able to handle the complexity now in ways that I wasn't able to do a few months ago when I first started this book. So we learned, though, I think from exaggeration and maybe even our distortions and our mistakes, they sort of self-correct in a group like this, because someone else will supply something else or have a different angle on it, and I find something that starts to rebalance. So thank you.
So I thought, Johnny, that your cautionary remarks were, right on the bottom and important to raise in this context. Like Matteo said, it was not only, well, it was beautiful, but it was also, I thought, brilliant in a way to bring these issues forward. And, the reference, the Mead comment about, I tend to think of it as a double thing. It's the atomic bomb and the Holocaust, because they are almost simultaneous in some sense with each other. And both have changed the way we conceive of ourselves as human beings. And so I was thinking back of Matteo's reading of Savitri today, and this idea that one has to go through hell in order to get this awakened state. Well, in a sense, what you're kind of saying is all human beings born today are, in a sense, at least partially born in hell because of this change in the history of humanity. Yeah. And so we come with the black, dark shadows, wings, dark wings that are attached to all of us, and we have to, that's part of our condition and part of what we have to do.
And we can't kick the can down the road anymore.
No.
Enough of us are going to have to face it. Yeah, well, we're going to have to face it. There won't be many generations ahead of us if we are, if enough of us are not able to integrate these shadow forces. It's a huge, huge dilemma for us all.
Yeah. I just want to ask, if I may, because Marco earlier had said that he was 80% convinced or persuaded of Aurobindo's account of evil in these chapters. Is that related to what John, Matteo, and Jeffrey are talking about? This kind of difference between maybe like just how like our very conception of evil is different now than is represented in this text?
Well, no, it is more a personal doubt that I have. I mean, it's just a philosophical doubt, if you wish. We can put it in this way. It was related to a thought that if there is this Brahman, this divine, omniscient, all-powerful being, yeah, why does it need evil, falsehood, ignorance, sufferance to evolve, to come out of matter, so to speak? Because in the view of Sri Aurobindo, the final, well, not final, but if there is a final, the final view of the aim, of the evolutionary aim, according to Sri Aurobindo, is to divinize matter. Okay, we have here an explanation why, what the function, what's the reason of falsehood and evil. And but if this being is so all-powerful, why do it not in a way that is more pleasurable, that is less difficult, that does not necessarily involve pain? So there is still for me some sort of doubt. There is something in the equation, a little parameter that is missing, for me at least. Maybe but it was more a philosophical doubt. As such, the function of this dark side of our existence is clear, is makes very sense to me. That was a also less than 20%, I would say, 10%, 5%.
You know, I confess, I think we could get this altruistic thing. We can get a pseudo-altruism about future generations and their survival. I think at one time when I was younger, that was very compelling, and it's not very compelling to me now. Because at our current level of development, I don't think it's that important if we survive. I would think it's a blessing, actually. I think that if I thought this was it, I would just break out the booze and have a ball, you know, and hunker down like most of the people on Wall Street do every night after they've made millions of dollars playing around with their algorithms. But I think that kind of nihilism is encouraged and supported, certainly in the city where I live. But I think you have to be against that temptation, that ever-present temptation to just say, oh, well, this is just too much work. I think there are multiple futures that we could use our creative imaginations in a way that conditions could be created for that actualization. So, and I'm doing that not because it's for survival, but just because it's much more interesting. So I'm sort of driven by the aesthetics of relationships, such as what we're having here and other places, and hopefully in other groups that we work with. And that's why I find I'm drawn to the poetry of this book, because to me it's not just a cognitive framework and getting it down and doing a pop quiz and saying, oh yeah, I got Aurobindo. It's much more to me about, you know, the head, heart, gut in some sort of alignment with the environment that's ever-shifting and kaleidoscopic. And, and there are moments when we have vertigo and it's extremely confusing and extremely paradoxical, and that self-reflexive consciousness that is mentioned earlier by Jeffrey and others, I think it's going to be really crucial for our ability to, and I think this is what Aurobindo was doing, is that we don't have to be driven by the vital and these powerful archetypal energies, that we can modify and modulate our affects. And I think that's when we had these wonderful blends and new ways of using language and metaphors and poetry and art, I think, are going to be increasingly important, so that we can sort of train our imaginations in healthier ways. But I think we're all, you know, very prone, that the vital is very attracted to disasters and and to creating them in a way. So I appreciate where Aurobindo is coming from, you know, watching how we oscillate back and forth between these different levels and get stuck or attracted to certain kinds of phenomena and get trapped into, these oscillations. So it's a challenge.
When I'm at my best, the vital is boring. It's been tried. Even within my small time frame, it's been tried. But if you want to use the human scale, we've all been drunk with something in some sense, whether it's an entire epic of human disaster or Dionysian absurdities. But when I'm at my best, I want to divinize matter, now that I think about it. I don't want to go for the ice cream. I found out you can freeze grapes, and that's a really, really nice treat. Should try it. But that, it really appeals to me. And I made the mistake earlier that when I said absolute evil, I think I meant absolute nothingness. Why, not necessarily, why is there not nothing, or why is there, why can't there be nothing rather than something? I guess that was maybe more of my question 10 years later that I asked myself a couple of years ago. And I think Aurobindo does a good job of explaining why there's got to be something, and why there's got to be more than just something that we've been doing, why there's got to be more than the animal drive to smash an ant, and more than the human drive to be mental, in more ways than one, I guess. But so it's really appealing, and it's, I mean, I'm sold on it. I, like Johnny said, I'm not going to any ashram, but that's more because I'm a poor man in Kentucky. But I can do this myself with the help of all of you here, and it's appealing. It's interesting and exciting, and it's one of the few places that hasn't really been fully explored. And I've always wanted to be an explorer, so that's why I'm here.
If I may connect to what Matteo said previously, it may be a coincidence, but I'm just reading in these days the mother of Sri Aurobindo, and it, I can really suggest to this reading. First of all, because it's not so, it's not 1,000 pages, it's much smaller, so you... It's not so, it doesn't take away so much time, but it is in three parts, and one, but it looks much, it looks much.
It's only the first 25 pages of this book. The rest is Sri Aurobindo's letters on the mother.
Okay. Because the first part, it makes a very good summary about the surrender. Surrender in yoga, in integral yoga. And when I read it, I get into a state of surrendering that I would like to keep all the day, but I can't. No? But when you read this, it's really a good introduction also to the synthesis of yoga, maybe. No? The second part is about money, surprisingly. Which is also might be also very useful these days. And the third part, Matteo also described, and so you him. It's really a very powerful reading. And I read this, and the interesting thing about Sri Aurobindo writings, but maybe not only about Sri Aurobindo writings, about many deep spiritual writings, is that when I take them up again, maybe 1 year, 2 years, or several years later, I forgot completely some parts that did not struck my consciousness, my mind, being when I read it for the first time, but they struck me now. Or I see the same thing from a completely different perspective. And this is something that I think you can get very much in Sri Aurobindo, that you read something and you go over it again after a while and you see not something different, but something which is complementary. And that's very powerful because it gives you the view from different aspects of the same thing. And also this reading happens again, because I read it also several years ago and I took it up again now. And then there was something I was, oh, I forgot, I don't know. I'll say it later.
I wanted to ask you, Matteo, in relation to that five line section of Savitri that you read, it seems to me that there are obvious parallels between that and Paradise Lost. And I wondered whether or not, Aurobindo was, you know, because there's a kind of a friction between the two, and not friction in the sense of bad, but in the sense of a warming between the two texts. I don't know if you have any comments about that.
He loved Paradise Lost. There's a lot of similarities between Paradise Lost and Savitri. It was sitting on his bookshelf, and a lot of the words, word usages, and Paradise Lost is written in blank verse, in quantitative meter. I think 10 syllables per line also. And he was a fan of Milton. And I've only had a single pass through Paradise Lost, so I don't know the work well, but I had a single pass through it after I've read Savitri more than a dozen times. So I did have that frame of reference, and I was seeing a lot of, because I, at that point when I read Paradise Lost, I already knew Savitri well, and I was seeing so many links and ties in. I'd like to have another pass through Paradise Lost, but there's similar. You're right to see similarities there.
Because even the opening passages of Savitri has a little bit of the feeling of the scope of Paradise. It has the same kind of sonority, the same kind of large view of things. It seemed to, you know. So
in future poetry, he has a large section on Milton and on Shakespeare and on the Romantic poets. And on Mallarmé, I mean, the guy read quite a bit of poetry, so you can, I think, and he does make a passing reference to Satan in this chapter, I think. So, I think those echoes are there.
I just want to note, as we're getting kind of toward the end of the call, we still have some minutes, but the big chunking of this book, book one, book two, and then book two into two parts, it seems like we're going past this, all the chapters dealing with evil, ignorance, the ego, error, falseness, etc. And we're going to be kind of on the upslope as we read part two of book two. I didn't know exactly how to characterize it. When we started this book, Matteo, you said that this was Aurobindo's epistemology.
Oh, yes, book two. I'm sorry. I thought you meant the whole of Life Divine. Yes.
So is there a way that, having read this so many times and having a sense for his complete works, is there a way that we could think about or approach this next set of chapters?
Just simply with his title for part two, The Knowledge and the Spiritual Evolution. Right, part one that we're just finishing is the infinite consciousness and the ignorance. And we're transitioning to the knowledge and the spiritual evolution. And there's a lot of these chapters were new also to the publication. I think the last two, don't quote me on this, but I think that the last two chapters, maybe even the last three, were not published in the Arya. So they're circa 1940, 1941 or something like that. I don't know that. I haven't checked that. Yeah, a lot of it's focused on, there's a lot of yogic process coming into this. And I'm glad Marco talked about the early chapters of the mother. The mother has six chapters, and a lot of it, there's so much there's so much practical processes of how to do yoga in that little book, that it's a powerhouse of a little book. And his treatise on money is super unique, but just kind of staying with these triads that he links together: aspiration, rejection, and surrender. Rejection could also be termed discernment rather than like rejection of trying to get rid of things. It's not like that. It's a language thing. But then also faith, sincerity, and surrender. And this faith is a deep part of integral yoga practice, kind of flashing back to when I talked about the history of the record of yoga. Debashish Banerjee's The Seven Quartets of Becoming is based on the record of yoga. And the seven quartets are these 28 yogic processes that he says were given to him by Swami Vivekananda in disembodied form in Alipur jail in 1911. But there's like faith is Shraddha. There's beautiful writings. There's whole chapters in Synthesis of Yoga on faith and faith and Shakti and things like that. I don't know. But this little book that Marco is talking about is so powerful. If anyone wants to kind of jump into how to take the theory from the Life Divine and distill out different practices, that might be a good start.
You know, because I think I had a slightly, my experience was interesting, like of the second part. I think unlike John, I enjoyed the first part more for its content, but I felt that in the second part I started getting the hang of reading, so I could follow the argument, and even though it's really complex, and you know I couldn't reconstruct it completely, you know, as he lays it out in the text, I got the hang of it. But it's also, I think perhaps what I was alluding to earlier, everything dealing with the limitations of the self, the plane of mentality, essentially. And that aspect of it, I think I started to find kind of suffocating, you know? Like, I want to know what's beyond the mental. I want to know I want to have a clearer reception of that intuition that he talks about here. It's another part of this the mental ignorance is met by, and it kind of it sort of misapprehends an intuition of the clarity of the infinite or the supramental. And I wonder if it's fair to think about these last chapters as the clarification in some way of the intuition of the supramental, the intuition of, you know, what is beyond the confusion, the evil, the ignorance, the, you know, the partiality, the fragmentary quality of mental existence. I'm looking at you, Matteo, but maybe I shouldn't be necessarily. I guess part of what is arising, and I've tried to articulate this in a couple of different ways, is, you know, it takes a lot to get to take on a book like this. I mean, you did it 12 times. Just reading it once is a lot. It's a big effort.
No, Savitri. Oh, Savitri. More than not this book. I don't, yeah.
Savitri is a thick volume. So, you know, and we've, I think played with different ways of reading, different elements that we've brought into it. We've chanted, we've meditated, we've philosophized, we've done poetry. I feel that these last books or something are something special, is just my sense. And I'm wondering how we can really bring, like Doug was saying, like our, you know, when we're at our best, like what could we bring to this final leg, you know, of the book? Because it seems to really offer itself to this other movement, this other possibility. And you know, I don't want to overestimate it. I don't want to posit it as better than what we just read, but I'm looking forward to it, I guess is what I'm saying. It's like, it's almost like the dawn after the long night. And so I feel that some kind of rethinking or reorienting toward how we're doing this may be appropriate.
You're not necessarily asking what can the text do for us. You're asking what can we do with the text.
Yeah, very much so.
I kind of feel, sorry, Matthew, I didn't mean to. I kind of feel, I may be wrong about this, and maybe Matthew or whoever could correct me about it, but I sort of feel like the pieces that he's given us so far are, they set up the problem, but they don't really solve it. They sort of lay out the pieces, but there are kind of paradoxes built into these pieces in ways that, for me, aren't fully resolved at this point. And my sense is it's the evolutive part that offers some kind of resolution to these paradoxes that are built in at this point. And maybe that's a personal thing, because in my own writing and my own work around the ideas of God and divinity, it's the evolutionary part that I built in as the solution to the problems that come from it. So in a way, it aligns with my own understanding of things. And that's why I think I'm maybe projecting rather than intuiting his truth. But that's a little bit the way I'm dealing with the next section, I guess.
I don't think, this is just my gut feel here. I don't think we should try to be better than we already are. I think we can get really, I think that's just the ego, a self-improvement scheme. It's, you know, it's so easy to think that the supramental is something still beyond us. And actually, I think when we're at our best, it's actually the new ordinary. You can walk down the street in a certain state where you're in a flow state. And even if there are problems and issues, that you can handle them and gracefully. And I think there's a kind of, the inner and the outer start to unfold one another. And I believe that's very fractal. And that comes out of the metaphors that we, you know, our current science and our culture has co-evolved together. So I think we should just continue to play around with metaphors and stories and share our favorite passages. Maybe Doug will come up with a ditty or a song or something like that. Someone can bring a guitar. You know, I don't think we should get too caught up in this, you know. I just speak from experience I find there's a strong tendency when you're hooked into this ascending current to crash and burn. And I think then you get really up, you know, in despair because you're not enlightened enough. And I just think we should just be very cautious and very gentle with ourselves and our frailties and our foibles. And anyway, that's just my feel, because I sort of admire you, Marco, so much. You're such a maverick, and you want to plant your flag on that mountaintop and claim it. And I so much want to follow you. But at this point, I think maybe we should just, like, it's a slippery slope. Let's find, if there's a foothold, okay, let's establish that. And we let everyone else know that. This is a safe place. You know, you can put your foot here. And we can just take it one step at a time. And you know, maybe we'll get to that, the top of the mountain, look down, and maybe breathtaking. And then we have to climb back down after we've ascended to the top. Because I don't think enlightenment happens up there. I think it's going to happen in the valley. Anyway, it's a tremendous archetypal energies, you know, are flowing through us, even if we're not aware of it, maybe in a conscious way. I think just reading this book starts plugs into a current. I've certainly been aware of that. So anyway, that's my two cents. But I'm very attracted to the Gnostic being. You ask for volunteers. What is a chapter you would like to sort of cultivate and maybe shape it a little bit, shape a presentation around? I think I read something that you and Tony were writing about this earlier. So anyway, the Gnostic being, I'm very, very drawn to. Is that the title, The Gnostic Being? Yeah.
Well, my goal with this reading is to really get this. I want to understand this book. You know, I want to get all of this reading and say to myself, so I have a you know, general understanding of what he wanted to do with this book. And my goal is to get this material. And I have a certain, I come with certain ideas, and I come with certain preformed notions. And what I find in a book is definitely different. And I think someone should bring a guitar, and you know, we should have a good time and so on. And we should take it light. But you know, I suggested that maybe next time someone could just, you know, I can do it next time. Just write a little introduction and structure the discussion a little bit more around, you know, this narrow 50, 60 pages or whatever it is. And yes, so my idea would be that, you know, for the next, I can volunteer for the next two chapters. I will write like 3 or 4 pages, and then, you know, read those out loud. You know, I'm a terrible writer, will be totally embarrassing, but you know, I can do it. And then maybe the next chapter, someone else will do it.
That's my philosophy too. If I can do it, then you can too. So if I often put myself out there just because I'm nervous or fumble on my words. So thank you, Tony, for stepping up. We'll look forward to it.
Yes, I like this idea. I vote in favor. also, if it obviously it will take a bit of work for every time that one takes has to make this effort. And a little parenthesis that I would like to make. I don't know. Okay, that's too late now to say this because we are reading The Life Divine, and it obviously it makes sense to stay on The Life Divine. But as much as I could see, The Life Divine is not the best first reading. At least the most of the people that I know did not come to Sri Aurobindo through this reading. Not because it's not, but quite the contrary, because it's already a quite high level. And sometimes the first contact, the first perception is not always easy to digest all the things that he says. As to myself, I got to this only later, much later, when I encountered him. I first read Satprem. I don't know if it was a disciple of the mother who made his own books and explained, made his own his own summaries about the philosophy of Sri Aurobindo and integral yoga. But this was not something of Sri Aurobindo, so maybe I could not, this should not be suggested as a further reading. But what was very useful for me was Letters on Yoga. In the Letters on Yoga, Sri Aurobindo is much more colloquial. He comes much more down to earth and explains the things that you can read here with a language that it is easier to understand, because these were questions of his disciples and to which he wrote his answers in a colloquial language without poetry and without particular complicated philosophical notions. And then, after I have gone through not all, but because it's a lot, there are thousands of letters, but many of these letters, and where all the different aspects were explained, I came back to this reading. This was very helpful. This was very helpful. So maybe also another suggestion might be also to, of course, go on to the Life Divine, remain focused on this, but sometimes here and there take some texts and some sources also from elsewhere. I'm not suggesting necessary Letters on Yoga. Of course, also Savitri and Synthesis of Yoga also. Synthesis of Yoga is also, again, more or less at this level. But maybe it might be useful to take also some other sources to integrate the reading that we are focused actually now.
Would that be a good idea to do after we finish this book? Like have a session after we finished it to like bring in supplementary readings like you've suggested? And when would we do it?
Also, yes, okay, that would be okay too, but not necessarily. But for example, online we had a bit this discussion about the ego. What exactly we mean by ego, what I mean by what you mean by ego, what does Western psychology mean by ego, and what does Sri Aurobindo mean by ego. And there was a little bit of confusion. So it was very useful for me to say, okay, let me see. Nowadays it's easy because almost all the writings of Sri Aurobindo nowadays you find them in PDF, in the PDF format online. Just Google it, find it, and a little bit of research, it's very easy. And there, maybe also during this reading, take some excerpt here and there from other writings, and to integrate, and might be good as a complementary reading.
I would support you in doing that.
Yeah,
I think it'd be great if you would initiate that, because you've read a lot more and you have a lot more to choose from than I do, and it would give me the benefit of your expertise here. So I hope you will.
As I said, I also use the search engine. That's it. But if there is, for example, maybe we should also agree what the parts which are less easy to understand, what we don't understand really, and someone can then in a week make a little research and bring it forward then in the session. If you tell me what, I can do it also, yes.
I appreciated the discussion about that. My problem is that reading Aurobindo is the limit of my capacity right now, so I don't have the time or the, you know, in order to look at other texts. I have to do it at the end, but I'm stuck right now to do other stuff. So I sort of follow Johnny. If you can do it for us, that would be great. But I mean, Matteo does it because Matteo, you know the text so well, you can dip into the text and bring up pieces for us. Like that, but those of us who are new to,
or no, but I didn't mean that every one of us should do that. Some I can do this eventually next time. If there is some topic, I can just find a page that someone can read in 3 minutes. Yeah. That's all. Yes,
the general idea would be that someone would prepare something for the next reading, for the next chapters.
So what I was going to say, though, is, Tony, if you just propose to do chapters 15 and 16, I believe, I will take on the task of doing chapters 17 and 18, which are two dealing with the evolution. So they fit within my framework and... I will do like Doug says, I'll throw myself the deep end and figure out some way to orient that.
Yes. So for me, I'm actually, my idea with this reading was that I just focus on this one book and don't read anything of the mother or anything in the periphery, because for myself, I know, my own power of my mind lies in just concentrating on something for an extended period of time, and I'm extremely bad at multitasking, Yes.
I have just one suggestion, but it's kind of a re-suggestion. I do a lot of group work and circle work in a lot of different forms around these things, and the one thing that I will suggest is practically impossible, but I love the idea of it. And that's going back to everybody, not only everybody being on mute when they're not sharing, but having the agreement to have 4 or 5 human breaths between someone muting because they're done talking and the next person unmuting because they have some sort of intimation that's coming to them. I find that those 4 or 5 breaths actually create it kind of quiets the ego, because my ego's not jumping in to say something and wanting to be heard. And it kind of like settles a lot of those 4 or 5 breaths after someone mutes, settles a lot of the being, so that maybe the next thing said is, it's something changes in the texture of the circle if that agreement can be held. But I also have, in my experience, it's this group is amazing at not fixing people's problems and not having like snippy crosstalk. I find this group, I find a lot, I kind of delight and look forward to coming together with this group, because I find a lot of maturity here. And yeah, but there are a number of things. That's just one suggestion in circle to work with, is going back to that kind of that pregnant pause between muting and sharing. I too don't have capacity to take on anything more than the 50 pages a week. I'm like really maxed out with capacity. But I honor and appreciate everyone's wanting to bring more things forth, and I honor what John said also with having a beware sign pop up of trying to be something more than the beauty that's already present.
I'll just say that I appreciate all those suggestions, and including the suggestions not to fixate on what we might bring forth or what we might bring to the readings. I think we've brought so much already, just our presence here, that we show up week after week, and I feel really present. For me, these are some of the most intensely present times of my week, the reading and then the time together. And I find it has these reverberations through my other activities. And I'm also aware that it's passing, and this will happen and something else will happen. But that, you know, when we, I get this with my daughters a lot because, you know, they grow up so fast and you want to savor, you know, each moment when they smile or do something sillier or whatever it is. So I feel a little bit like that about this opportunity, because there's so much to read. There's so much like on my list for sure. And I know all of us are readers. And I find sometimes that when you're focused on getting through, getting to the end, getting through your list, etc., that you can sort of treat the book just as more text rather than as the invitation into an intimacy or into a depth. Maybe this is something I'm just detecting in myself as well, which is why I'm bringing it up, and it's not really, you may or may not resonate with it, but that's all. I mean, I just wanted to mark the fact that we're making a transition from one section of the book to another. And so it's an opportunity to meta, you know, to go meta, reflect on how we're doing what we're doing, and sort of prepare for the next step.
And I hope we will, as we've done with other books, when we finish a book, we have an extra session so that we could just sort of talk about the whole process and the different strategies that we used, and some that worked and some that didn't, and then what happens next, because there may be other texts that we want to continue working on. I mean, I want to get to some of the other texts that have been mentioned here. Savitri, I'd love to read. And what's that other one you guys, The Synthesis of Yoga, that's on my shelf too. So, but I definitely feel like I'm more competent reader of Aurobindo now, so I can handle those books on my own. But if there are other people who want to participate in another group, that would be great. That's entirely possible, because we're pretty flexible here. Thank you.
I have one comment when we stop recording.
You don't want to make that public, this statement? We'll stop the recording then.
Stop the recording for just a second.
Blessings, everybody.
Pause it, I believe. So pause. Recording again.
What I do love, I guess the most about reading this book and about Aurobindo, I think he has enormous confidence. and I really admire that about him. I don't feel like he's over the top or, you know, sort of, I don't know, there's this humility there for sure. And I never feel like he's talking down to anybody. So I really admire those qualities enormously in him. That comes through in the writing. But that confidence, even if I don't agree with him or I have a disagreement, I think that's a quality that I think I'm taking away from this is too. You know, that kind of self-confidence, we really need that kind of stability and that confidence in our human nature, that we can be very generous and magnificent beings. It's sort of set up for us to be that way. And when we're at our best, I believe we all had glimpses of that. So I just want to continue to cultivate those possibilities. And I believe I see lots of evidence from everything that you guys have been bringing to this discussion, that we're all doing the best we can. So thank you very much. I have to go. Blessings to everyone. Thank you.
Good night. Bye-bye.
Good night, all.
Bye. Good night.
Thanks, guys.
Bye, Lauren.
Bye, Oro.
He's playing. Busy boy.
Just sit down on the ground and draw.
Something else that Sri Aurobindo has that doesn't come through in the Life Divine is humor. Oh my goodness, like humor like you wouldn't believe. It comes through and it pops up in letters. It definitely pops up in evening talks. It pops up in some of the smaller writings, but there is someone, I don't have the book, I don't know the title, but there is someone that put together a compilation of humor in Sri Aurobindo's writings. There's sometimes I've been put on the floor laughing so hard. It takes me by surprise, but it's there. I have to go too.
Yeah, Thank you. Good night, everybody.
Good night.
Ciao, and good night.
Bye-bye. Tschüss.